let's try again. We left off explaining this special instruction get element pointer, which is used to access the slots in your compose data structures. And what you do is you at first give it the address of the struct that you want to navigate in, and you give the index of the field that you want to access. And you can also continue giving further indices, so you can then write I64. This is just the data type for the thing that follows. For the navigational instructions like get element pointers, you won't really ever exceed the limits of your 64-bit integers, well, for most cases, but yeah, it's okay. So with this expression, you would first navigate to the second component in... this should probably... For this example, it should be the one. You would navigate into the first subcomponent of struct A. This is an included struct B, and in there you would navigate the second component. So this will be this one. So it goes recursively into the nested structures. That's the idea. Yeah, you have instructions to load from memory. These are in general also typed to help you in identifying what this will have as a type. And also this determines what further get element pointers that are called on this variable 2 will actually be resolved to. Yeah, and then there's possibilities to call. In this case, it is an indirect call. So we will be navigating to the struct A's pointer. We will load it from there, and then we will call it with 42 or something. Okay. So that is the rough introduction into what LLVM intermediate representation looks like. Ah, one thing probably. You see these identifiers popping up with a percent sign in front. Well, these are variables. The ones that are full text variables are actually real program variables that come from a translation. And there's also so-called temporaries. These are the ones that are numbered from one to whatever, and they serve as a kind of abstraction of the stack. So, in contrast to what we've seen so far in virtual machines, this is a register machine with unlimited registers as a kind of abstraction, and it doesn't need to use the stack so often for things. Also, you can use parameters directly and don't have to pass them on the stack. Yeah, there's a few tools that can be used in order to get support from the whole LLVM framework and its incorporated C or C++ front end, which is this Clang or C language program, and you can use it to generate certain helper structures for the whole thing. So, for example, you can produce the memory layouts that we'll see further on for your constructs by calling this lengthy expression. So you have a clang call, which first of all you always have to tell him to emit LLVM code in order to get the intermediate representation of the things that are important for intermediate representation. And in this case, with the dump record layouts, you'll get the structure of the memory objects that we'll see afterwards a little bit more in detail. Also, if you want to get code like we've seen before, like this one, you can use Clang to directly compile a C or C++ code into. And you do that with this beast here. The most important thing is telling it to emit LLVM, and also telling it to produce intermediate code. Then you can hand it some kind of C or C++ code, and it will emit the intermediate representation. So that's your tool set that you get for the next few things. Okay, so let's start with plain old things that we've already seen in the last lecture. There's the object layout for single inheritance. So what we have is we have a base class A, and it has certain things like an attribute A and ordinary method, object method F. And you can now try to do a few inheritance steps by introducing class B and class C, both of them inheriting from each other or from the base class A. And what this will produce is this will recursively build up a structure for C in the end. So there will be a basic a memory object for A, which just consists in... so we will have... In fact, we will start with something that that holds only the int A. Then it will be extended if as soon as you introduce the inheritance with B. So it, no. So it will grow like this, and will be added extended with a B slot, and then we will have finally the extension to a C class, and it will be appended with a C. No? Why not? Okay. So this is how these objects are constructed. They are just recursively appended to their predecessor. Why is that? That is because we want to reuse code. That's what we have already heard. And how does that... What is the implications of that? Well, whenever you use some kind of a cast or something, so if you use code like BB, it's a new C or something, then the whole thing will create an object representation like this one, and whenever you then use B's G with something, you've heard that this G must in general be possible to access everything that the B objects in general have in their visibility scope. So it needs to see this part, and with casting you can just hand the pointer to the C down to the B, from the C down to the B. So in both cases the object starts right here at the beginning, and you can just use the same pointer for B and C, and as the scope only grows you can always navigate from the same offset. So that is why we create the whole thing like this. Yeah, in case that we have just single inheritance and object methods, everything is easy, because for translation you can just do things that you see over there. You can just directly call the methods you want to call, like this G, for example. This one is... There's no virtual dispatching involved, and there's no special inheritance involved. You can just give it as its prominent first parameter the pointer to the object representation, and then call it directly, because G is statically known and can be given an address. So that is what our status is so far. So let's try to extend it a little bit with, for example, virtual methods. So what LVM and also GCC and Visual C++ do in this respect is that they introduce something that is called a virtual table. Why is that? Well, the idea here is that for virtual methods, you then introduce a pointer, which is always at the very beginning, the very start of the object representation. And this virtual pointer is used to point to an area of memory where the actual addresses that where we need to dispatch to are collected. as you've seen yesterday, we talked about the way that virtual methods were brought into our C machine with this init virtual instruction. I told you that there was there's some runtime overhead by using this. In these cases where we have the LVM way of doing it, the compiler at compile time generates these virtual tables and never modifies them again. And everything that's done is whenever you create memory like the one for one of these C objects, you just place one virtual pointer inside instead of writing all the virtual addresses of the methods in there. So there's a lot less of work, and also you can just use templates for the memory area for C. So yeah, that is what's done in LVM. How does the virtual machine code look like in this case? Well, once again, we are using an object of type C, and we are trying to call a G. And the difference to before, we now have to use an indirect call, as virtual methods might be overwritten at some place. So the generated code differs a little bit from before, and what the main thing is that we have to go the way that this arrow goes over here to the memory where the virtual table is stored, and then we have to navigate for the call to G, for example. We have to navigate to the second slot in there, which is which has the number one. So we navigate with the get element pointer to the, in this case, first slot, and get the relevant address. We need to load from the area here, and then in the end call indirectly to this thing. So that's what you do for virtual methods. So far, not so big of a difference. It's just another mechanism that we have here for object layouts. One little side note, probably, on these virtual tables, we have a pretty similar way of incrementing the space whenever we introduce a new class. This one also grows downwards with more children, and you can also apply the same scheme here. The start of this virtual method is always at the top, and as soon as you have more special signatures there, you append them to the bottom, and you can still use part of this thing whenever you cast to a parent. So that is still fine. Okay, so that's about virtual methods. Yeah, the most exciting thing now is, what do we do when we have several parent objects? And yeah, this is the situation that you see here. Code-wise, the whole thing looks like this, that you have, no, not like this, that you have two parents from which you inherit. And this means that an object of type C will see all the attributes and methods that types A and B provide, although, for example, B does not know about A and A does not know about B. So that is how the whole thing works. Still, our main principle is that we want to reuse as much of the code we have generated beforehand in our multiple base classes situation, so that we can kind of generate the code for classes A and B with our standard concepts, and don't have to care about whether they are later on used in a multiple inheritance situation. So all that this multiple inheritance needs to add to the whole thing needs to be added transparently, so that the classes that do not mention multiple inheritance, like this one, can be just generated the way that they were before. So how can we achieve that? So first of all, we need to come up with a way to to represent the whole situation in the memory. So for A, we have a fixed memory pattern already. That's just the slot for A. For B, we also have a pattern, and the idea is that we have to connect them in some way. So we have to put them one after the other. So it doesn't really matter which of them is in on top of the other. It's just one way that you need to come up with while compiling. The important part is that the C is the only class that knows about that the structure is now combined. So it is important that important for the C that it has it's attached to the bottom here. The way now is that we can reuse everything as long as we are using this C. The most exciting thing happens as soon as you start casting now, because as soon as you downcast to something like B, then you have to do something about your start of the object, because the start of the object for code that is written for B is thinking that the pointer that it is that it gets is actually pointing to the B and not to the very top of the object representation. So that's what makes the whole thing a little bit complicated. As long as we don't have any casting involved, everything is fine. You see the situation here where we call a B method. In this case, we can do everything as we are used to. We can just navigate inside the representation of the whole C object to the to the fourth slot. That is the one where, in this case, the element pointer is thought of as byte size. So we need to go four slots further. As this int A is actually 32 bits long, we can see that in here. This means that we will navigate to this B section of the whole thing. And that is what the get element pointer here does. And we use that in order to give our method call to G the right starting address. So this is something that can be still done at compile time. We can compute how many slots we need here, and we just hand it down to this static method call. So far it's not so complicated. We just have to adapt the starting address of our sub-object. So nothing too special here. But we can start to introduce ambiguities with this situation with multiple parents. So, what is the typical situation? Yes?
Just a question to the casting stuff.
Yeah.
So now, if you have, for instance, the pointer to B, but you disinfect the C object and you upcast again, do you then just subtract the difference?
You can upcast, yes, but that in this case it would probably statically work so far. But yeah, that is a not so easy thing to do in general, and we'll see afterwards why it is not so easy and how it can be really achieved in practice. Yeah, but yeah, that is actually a problem if you want to go back. In this case, it's not, because it's there's static differences between the object fragments, and you can just add or subtract the difference once again and be back at the beginning. But later on, it won't be so easy anymore. So, yeah. Anyway, what you buy yourself into is that you run into complications as soon as you have parents that both specify implementations for the same signature, because whenever you call, then you don't really know which one you're referring to, so the compiler will bail out. And yeah, what's the solutions for this? There's different solutions for different languages. For the ones that we are treating with C++. Well, for this one, the solution is explicit qualification. If you encounter that situation, you need to explicitly tell the compiler which one you're referring to. There's also other systems which have something like a kind of magical, automatical solution to this thing by having the compiler compute a kind of hierarchy on the parents and preferring one parent to the other. Yeah, there are certain upsides and downsides for both of these approaches. For solution one, you could argue that as soon as you change your hierarchy a little bit, you need to re-engineer all your components that you have explicitly qualified. If you introduce, for example, another layer of objects in between, you need to adapt the names that you have statically included here to something, to your modifications. So that's a little bit clumsy to do, and might be not so elegant. But the problem that solution two has, for example, is that as soon as a compiler does some automatic things to resolve an ambiguity, you need somehow a kind of feedback or a way to see how this resolution is done. And for these ambiguities in multiple inheritance, turned out that there's a lot of bad ideas out there. Well, in terms of algorithms for linearization that change the way that one parent is preferred to the other, when you modify some class that is not really connected to them directly in between. So yeah, you have to come up with a really, really clever solution for the whole thing. Also a solution that seems really intuitive to programmers in order to not confuse them. Yeah, it's a little bit tedious. That is, of course, as long as you really provide implementations for these things, as long as you only provide the signatures only, there's no implementation involved, and then having ambiguities from which of the two class specifications our signature comes from doesn't matter anymore, because the signature is then matching anyway. So that is about ambiguities in the whole thing. Yeah. Next, we should have a look at how virtual methods change everything when we have multiple inheritance, because this really inserts a lot of trouble. Yeah, why is that? Well, once again, with virtual tables, we lay out our objects as we had before, just one after the other, A, B, and C. So up to now, there's not so much of a problem. But it's correct. So let's have a look at the situation where we cast to one of the children. So let's have a look at this situation. In this case, what we're doing is we originate from the pointer to C, and we navigate inside the representation and come to a new pointer that is actually now pointing directly to B, and store this one in the pointer to B. So that is what this code does. So that, it's just a pointer adaption, but we need that for the next next statement that we need to look at. This is the one that interprets the call to F, and F is now a virtual function. We've seen it defined over here, and as a virtual function, it has an entry in the virtual table, and it has this entry specifically at the very first index where the virtual table pointer points to, because it was found as the very first virtual method in the first class here. Yeah, and yeah, what is now involved with the whole thing? We need to compute the virtual address from our object base pointer. So what we need to do is we need to navigate to the virtual table. Keep in mind that we have now at first a cast into the B part of the whole thing. So we're not starting from this point, but we're starting from this point over here. So yeah, what we're doing is we're loading the B pointer into memory, and the B pointer has at the very start the pointer to the virtual table. So what we do is we cast it to an array of function pointers. We navigate into the whole thing by loading, so we get the address here into variable 2. In there, we need to navigate to the right entry for f. The right entry for f is, well, the zeroth or the first entry, depending on how you interpret the whole thing. This must be this one, so we will get the element at spot 0. And then we load from there with this one, so we extract this address and then call to this one with our initial address. So this is the one from here. So you might wonder, why is there different virtual pointers? Well, you've seen that it is quite handy if you ever start from a parent that is involved in virtual inheritance. You can, right from the start, just take the very first element as your virtual pointer. But now you might ask, why do these two virtual pointers point to different sections in the virtual table? This has to do with the part that you see over here. And you must keep in mind the following thing. If you treat virtual methods with multiple inheritance, what you will be running in is situations where you have cast to the to a parent, and then call a method that belongs to a child. But if you have translated the method that belongs to this child method to this child class, for example this f here, it expects as its first implicit parameter a pointer not to its parent but to the very start of the object representation. So there's a mismatch here, and in order to get this mismatch patched in some way, what is done is we always have the same pattern for calling. This is just achieved by giving the pointer to the object on which we are calling to the callee. But as you see, we have introduced different entries in our virtual table, depending on whether we come through the way from here or from here. And depending on which way, we know how our base address of the object is actually looking like. So what we can do is, in this one, we can patch the first parameter that we get to point to the original start of the object in order to make use of the same implementation that we have when we would call the f that or well to make sure that the object base pointer is actually pointing to the children's space. So what is this technique called? That's just the layout of the virtual table. Let's have this is an intermediate slide so that you know how these tables are made up. So virtual tables now in the situation for multiple inheritance have further content that it didn't have before. Yeah, the pointers to these virtual tables go always to the first virtual method entry. So these are entry points into the virtual tables. These are the ones that virtual table pointers will point to from object representations. So positive indices added to our virtual pointers will navigate through all the entries for virtual table for virtual methods. Negative entries will get you into kind of administrative areas of your virtual tables. So there's spots that we won't look at too much. These are the runtime type information things. These are the ones that are not so interesting for us in multiple inheritance, or at least right now. But those who are really relevant for us are the offsets to the top of the object representations. These can be used to achieve the things that you've asked for already. These can be used for doing dynamic casting and getting the right top address once again. So yeah, that's something that we will see afterwards once again in action, but so far for now. And there's different sections of virtual tables. These I mark them as being separate with these lines over here. So these are two sections of the virtual table. One belongs to the object A, one to the object B. Also, what you have to keep in mind is that in principle, we would also have an object C, which also kind of needs a kind of a representation for virtual tables. But as C's object representation also starts at the same address as A, we share the space that it needs. So we will have C kind of implicitly uses the same pointer to navigate to the virtual tables. So this section will serve as the virtual table for A and C, and this one for B. Okay. Ah, probably once again, something for your toolset. You can use Clang to also emit your virtual table layout. In case you ever need to debug your code, that's probably quite nice to know. Yeah. The facilities that that we're talking now is thunks. Thunks are the things that provide this functionality of adapting your implicit this pointer to the correct starting address of the object that your method implementation actually expects. So these thunks are generated by the compiler and inserted into the virtual table. And especially in those virtual table parts that belong to parents that don't really see the correct start of the object representation. So what does a thunk look like? A thunk is a very short thing. What it actually does is it, in the end, it issues a call to the original implementation of the virtual method that is the most actual one, the most recent one. So one that is to be valid, but it inserts in between casts from the implicit this pointer to the correct start of the object. That's what you see here with this get element thing. This one navigates 16 bytes back in memory representation And if you once again have a look at how the memory representation of B looks like, it has two 8-bit slots, as far as I remember. There's the virtual table pointer, and there's also the element, I think it was B or something, that's also 8 bytes long, so this is the correct size for the B. And yeah, so this whole thing will adapt the pointer to that at first went into the middle of the object representation to point back to the very top of the whole thing. So that's all what a thunk does. You need that's the only thing that you keep in mind. Thunks are there to modify implicit this pointers to point to the things that it actually needs to point to. The thunks that we have treated so far are ones that are pretty schematic. The only thing that changes is, in fact, the number here. So we can, in our standard thunks, we only have a constant number that adapts this pointer. Yeah, but we're still not done yet. For multiple inheritance, there's other things that we can think of. For example, ancestors of parents. So, for example, you can program things like multiple inheritance start kicking off at C with two parents A and B, but each of them, parent A as well as parent B, are children of L. Semantically, what does that mean? That means that each of them carries its own representation for an L class with them. So for constructing the memory representation of A, you need to append all the content that A provides to L. Same for B. B needs to be constructed in a way that it has L before and then is followed by B. So both of them carry their own L's with them, and as soon as you use them here in C, you will copy their representations one after each other. So you append the B's representation to A's representation, that leads to these situations over here. Yeah, so apart from that, there's not so much difference. You can just treat those things as if they were the old A's and B's. It doesn't matter so much whether there is L's involved in the whole thing. The only thing that's a little bit problematic is that as soon as you start doing something like this, this means that you want to get a pointer to an L object from a C pointer, and well, the problem is actually you have two of them. With two of them, the compiler doesn't know which one you're actually referring to, so this is an ambiguity that needs to be resolved by telling the compiler explicitly which way to go. So in this case, over here, the whole thing is resolved by telling the compiler that we go down the A way, so from C to this L. Same thing is when you use static casts to go back up from your L implementation to C. Once again, it's not clear whether the L that you have here is this part or this part of a C object. So the compiler doesn't know whether statically to add this amount or this amount. Well, no, but that's wrong anyway. Whether to go this way, which is actually zero, or this way, which is actually delta B, to go to the beginning. So in this case, you would need either to do dynamic casting, or you need to actually tell him which way to go. Yeah. So that's what you get when you have distinguished base classes. More fun is using common base classes, because now there's a new dimension added to the whole thing, because now you have situations where the A knows about the fact that there's a W involved, as well as the B, but depending on in which context they are used, they need to share their implementation, their object space that is required for representing W. So A and B are still concatenated to each other. B is appended to A, and they are whenever they are used to implement such a C, but now they have to share something like W. And that's a little bit of a problem for the way that we navigated so far, because so far we always emanated from the fact that you could have a constant difference from children to their parents. But now, when you have to share something like W, in order to get a constant offset to this parent, you needed to place the A and the B in a way that this this constant difference is always the same. So, when you use them in different contexts and in different multiple inheritance scenarios and wherever you want to use them, this might turn out to be quite tricky, and actually is something that's not not so easily done at all. So the solution for the whole thing is that you, as soon as you do virtual inheritance, you won't have any constant offset anymore. So what you do is you do dynamic offsets to there, and how to how you can implement these is you need to store your pointer to where your virtual base is. And this is something that you that once again the virtual table is used. So far we had didn't have these entries over here, but just well, this one is different. But so far we didn't have the upper parts. Now we extend our virtual tables by another entry, and these are the entries that point to your virtual base. At least in LLVM, it is done like this. I think in Visual C++, these entries are in the object representation or object representations themselves. So there's minor differences in how the different compiler authors thought of how to implement the system. But LLVM and GCC are delivering something like this. So there's pointers to the virtual base, which are prepended to the virtual table. So they're fixed at the position -3 in your virtual table. So that's and these are giving the delta from your current object representation to the object representation of your virtual base. So in order to reference. You reference the flipping egg. In order to dereference this attribute W from inside an implementation of F in A, for example, you always need to do an indirect resolution via the W difference that is stored in the virtual table. Yeah, but that's what you get from. Okay, next thing is casting is not so easy anymore, as you have dynamic distances between object representations. That's particularly nasty in cases where you need to, for example, go back up from your parent W to your mother of all classes C, because the W really does not know by itself any constant difference to the start of the object, so you definitely need to query the this part in the virtual table, which tells for each class where to find its object start. So that's the only way how to go back to your object representation from the virtual base class. Also, you have to keep in mind there's one other spot in our implementation that needs to do casting of object start, no, modifying of object starts. And if you think back, there's the situation where you call virtual methods from parents, and those parents are probably not always know where the object starts is. This is particularly nasty if you do that from your virtual base class, because the virtual base class A doesn't know where the object is, and B it also knows that wherever it might be, it will be a dynamic offset to the object start. So that's really nasty, and in order to circumvent this, we once again extend the virtual table, and now it looks really, really ugly, because for each of the virtual table entries that are in there, we will have special thunks. These are now thunks that need to patch this pointer, not by a static amount, but by a dynamic amount. So these thunks are now called virtual thunks, in contrast to the normal thunks we had before, which could be seen as kind of static thunks, always adding only one constant. In this way, in this case, we have virtual thunks. These virtual thunks need to add a dynamic amount because we don't really know where the relevant object starts are in relation to our position. So, and even more, we might also need to navigate to different sub parts of our object. So we really need to remember for each of the virtual methods their associated object starts. So the only way to do that in the LLVM way is to remember for each of the virtual methods here an associated offset to the start of the corresponding method. So what we do there is, when we navigate through the list of virtual methods with a positive index like this, we can obtain the corresponding dynamic offsets to their object starts by going through negative indices in the virtual table part. Yeah, it's a little bit messy, but it actually works quite well. The virtual thunks are a little bit larger when you do them like this. So this is a typical virtual thunk. And yeah, it does a lot of navigation inside of the W part of the virtual table. It gets the elements at the right positions, and yeah. That's a little bit of a mess, but it turns out that in the end you can then reuse your old implementations that you've written for the G in this case, and yeah, in the end it turns out to work. Okay, so finally, how does a virtual table look like in presence of virtual multiple inheritance? You have different virtual tables for whenever you have a virtual subclass or a virtual base. What we always have is entries for virtual methods. So these and these. For either way, we have runtime type information that doesn't bother us. What we have is pointers back to the start of the object representation. Depending on where we are in our class hierarchy, these might differ, but in these cases we have 0 and delta W. For virtual subclasses, we have entries for the virtual base, so-called virtual base pointer. And in difference to that, we have in the virtual base, we have a whole table of indices which are used virtual call offsets which need to be added to the virtual table, virtual method entry, no, when calling one of these virtual methods, we need to add these virtual call offsets to the implicit this pointer that belongs to that call. So that's what virtual inheritance gives to you. Probably a little side note to make a little bit careful, if you're using the Microsoft's implementation of C++, this has a slightly different memory model in terms of exactly the implementation of multiple inheritance. So there's different organization of virtual tables. There's virtual tables and virtual base things, and they're kept different from each other, and you have two pointers inside your object representation, one to the virtual table and one to the virtual base organization stuff. So yeah, it's a little bit different, and especially badly documented, so yeah, good luck with that. But you should keep in mind that the basic principles are probably a little bit like this, and they might manage it a little bit different from that, but you need to do things like adding offsets to your virtual method calls when you're in a virtual base and something like that. So these ideas might help you in figuring out what the different entries actually are. Yeah, so what have we learned today? The first thing is something that I've canceled for this topic. So what we've seen is heap layouts for C++ implemented in LLVM. We've seen the corresponding LLVM IR representation, which is also quite interesting and a little bit different from the stack-based version that we've seen before. We've seen how to lay out virtual tables and objects. We've got to know that there's this aspect of linearization. We didn't stress it too far, so let's don't once again. We've also seen what the implications of different constructs that we had in multiple inheritance actually oppose on us as compiler construction guys. So that's all from my side for today. If you have any questions, yes. Actually, never really tried to re-engineer one of these examples, because this one was already so horrible. But I imagine that there will be several virtual base pointers in order to achieve that. Yeah, I would recommend to try it out. Actually, the output of the tools that I've mentioned earlier on, where were they? Like this one. That gives you the virtual table, and also the other one for the object layout, are quite fine. They do kind of ASCII art style of your object representation, and you also get the offsets written or annotated to the graphics, so it's quite nice. I would recommend to do so, especially if you want to really get the notion of what's going on in your code. If you liked topics like these, come to our winter semester's lecture, Programming Languages. We will have a focus on different object-oriented features in there. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? No? Then I thank you for your attention and have a nice week.